At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 926. It's the 17th of November 2017. On the podcast today, I have Neil Ricketts, CEO of Vrs, VRS. And Neil discusses their collaboration with a global consumer goods company. Also on the podcast, Dr. David Kahn, Chief Technology Advisor for Mayen Energy, MYN. And David answers questions on their current operational progress. I also have on Louis Coetzee, CEO of Kibo Mining, KIBO. And Louis answers questions on their updated MCPP MOU, their Environment and Social Impact Assessment Certificate Award, and the One Belt, One Road Summit Louis spoke at in Beijing. Plus, I also have on Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell, talking about River and Mercantile, Theresa, and Parity. We also discuss Trump and Twitter's tweeting exploits. Plus, as always, I have the top 5 most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top 5 most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Ricketts, CEO of Vrs. It's VRS ticker. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin, and just into a Friday morning, so brilliant.
Yeah, well, it's a bit later for you, of course, because you are across the pond there, and is it the ID, it's in the RNS, actually, you've got it today, ID Tech X show in Santa Clara, California, is that right?
Yep, finished late last night, and we got all packed up, and yeah, what a fantastic opportunity for the company. Really big thank you to the organisers for putting on such a great show.
Okay, but before we get into a bit of detail on that and what it's all about there, for people new to the story of Vrs or not have heard of you, give a quick explainer, Neil, as to what the business is about, please.
Yeah, I've been pitching this now for the last 2 or 3 days. We're a UK-based advanced materials company. We've got a massive opportunity in commercializing graphene. And the most important thing that's come out over the last couple of days is our relationships with the UK universities that we work with and how well-positioned we are to be able to exploit this new science.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the exciting RNS out is collaboration with Global Consumer Goods Company. And straight away I'm thinking, who could that be? There's a couple listed, obviously, in the UK, big ones, and there's only a couple I could think of. But that's big news, you know, really big news, and very exciting. So what's the details of this, and what will you be doing with them?
Like all programs, it's taken a while for us to get over the line. This is a global big player, and these things don't happen overnight. Unfortunately, we are under NDA with the company, which means that we're limited by what we can say. We tried to give the shareholders an update on our progress, but for the company, this is a massive step forward. This is playing with the big boys on the global stage, and for me as a CEO and the biggest shareholder, this is transformational news. This is I don't think people fully understand at this stage how big an impact this could have for the company. This is multiple projects with one of the world's leading players in packaging.
Yeah, well, it's becoming Neil, he can do a deal, because you are doing deals left, right and centre. And I assume now that you say you're getting traction here, and you've got, I always like the question, when you're looking at companies like you that has a lot of potential in the graphene space and advanced materials space, you've got to think, why would a massive company like this, a global player, you know, be hooking up with you? And you've got to have something special, you know? And so, what? And you've said in your release, and I said this a while back on the weekend podcast, where there's quite a few people trying to, you know, carve out or claim this, the bit in this space, the graphene space. But it's the one that gets ahead and starts getting ahead and starts getting approached and gets recognised as the pack leader. That's the one that will never get caught up. And it's like, you know, like in the sort of online estate agent, like Rightmove, like that, like ASOS in the fashion area. Once you start getting ahead, the bigger companies, it's self-fueling, isn't it? So why are they coming to you, Neil?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question. There are multiple players in the graphene field. I think it's fair to say that there's been a lot of hype around the sector. We've tried to differentiate ourselves both in terms of our message, but also in terms of the amount of support that we've got. I mean, talking to the US guys, they're a little bit behind Europe in terms of some of the development of graphene. You know, we've got a huge advantage in terms of our relationships with the University of Manchester and the University of Cambridge. We've got almost $1 billion worth of assets in the UK that we can leverage against with the Centre of Process Innovation, which we won an award, you know, we won a tender for a few weeks ago. We've got, that's a massive centre up in Durham in the north of the UK. We've got the National Graphene Institute, and we've got the Cambridge Graphene Centre. These are all partners, shareholders, and form a huge amount of credibility. I mean, I've got to be honest, Justin, this is an amazing time for the company. And, you know, I've never been in a position running a business that has the opportunities and the level of interest that we've currently got. Yesterday on the stand, you know, I'm not in a position to be able to name who came on the stand, but the opportunities that this company now has, you know, as the shareholder, I just can't believe, you know, and, yeah, this is a real big opportunity for us, and it's come around through genuine hard work and no political approach to the way that we explain the business and the way that we've gone about building the portfolio of test results and data that we've got. And you know, I can understand how, you know, some shareholders have been frustrated because it's taken us time to do that, but now we're really trying to, you know, we're really reaping the rewards of that. And when we talk to customers and we talk to the trade associations and we talk to the institutions, no matter whether it be in the UK or around the world now, we can talk from a position of authority, we can talk from a position of strength, and that makes a massive difference when you're talking to these big companies. You know, they haven't got time for, you know, spurious claims. What they want to see is they want to see independent data, and they want to know what difference our product can make to their products. And that is why these global players are coming to us now.
Yeah. Do you know what? So the person who came to the stand is very well known. Were they British or American?
No, this is the big difference here. It was actually, and the world has changed significantly. So we're in California, we're at an American exhibition, talking to an Italian company who is a global leader in what they do. Again, another household name in a completely different sector. And again, one of the things that we agreed as a management team at a very early stage was that we wouldn't be a one product, one sector, usual type of company that you sometimes get. What we've decided to do is that we would push ourselves really, really hard. We would de-risk the whole proposition, and we would look for a product that could be used in multiple sectors, multiple segments, and multiple projects.
Yeah. Okay. And like you said there, I assume you mentioned there, but you're always in discussions. And like you said, that last deal took around about 18 months, 2 years to come about. So you do have quite a few parties or things in the pipeline, do you?
Yeah, we...
nearing completion here, nearing announcement level.
Yeah, we've got an exciting run-up. I think I said in one of your podcasts that, you know, this is going to be a great Christmas. Hopefully this is the first Advent calendar present for our shareholders, but you know, we've got a stack of these lined up. Never any guarantees about what's going to happen. They're not signed until they're signed, and you'll notice from this release that this is a paid for program. We're not giving stuff away here. This is big companies, large global companies signing purchase orders with a relatively small UK company which is growing very, very fast.
Yeah, it's and you sound genuinely excited here, and it's almost like you haven't got enough hours in the day, I suspect, have you?
The last couple of days we've been working from 6 in the morning to 8 at night. I think one of our shareholders thought we were on I was on holiday, but we're working hard at this. It's genuinely a pleasure. My team is excited. You know, there's no doubt. We went into the city feels like ages ago now, a week or so ago, to raise some capital. The reason we needed to raise that capital is because the test programs for these big companies would put us under a huge amount of stress, in terms of capacity. And, you know, we had to move quickly, and we're going to have to move far quicker than I thought, because we've got multiple opportunities now. And even one of these opportunities, like we've announced today, you know, the potential to sort of suck up the capacity we've got was too large. Mm-hmm. So we had to take the option to raise cash. I am the single largest shareholder. I'm always cautious about dilution. I've always told our shareholders that we wouldn't dilute unless there's a really, really good reason. And I can assure you, there's a bloody good reason.
Lovely, Neil. Well, listen, if you needed to, if someone's listening right now and they're not, you know, following you on Vox Markets yet, but, they're liking the sound of the story, give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button, please.
I think the biggest reason that we've been able to demonstrate now is that we always deliver on what we say we're going to do. If there's an announcement and we say we're going to do something, we do it. And I think that we're building huge amounts of credibility now. I think the opportunity that we've got in this particular area, this new science, is probably unrivaled. And the third thing that I think is really, really important is that we are highly differentiated from the rest of this particular market because of the connections we've got with the University of Manchester and the University of Cambridge, which again all brings huge credibility for these massive global companies.
Excellent stuff, Neil. Get some sleep, some shut eye, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not too distant future, fella.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Justin, but if we could just do one of these early in the morning at UK time, that'd be just great.
Cheers, Neil.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. David Kahn, Chief Technology Advisor for Mayen Energy. That's MYN ticker. David, thanks for joining me again.
Good morning, Justin. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And the share price has certainly reacted positively since you've last been on. So you've had some news out, and we'll discuss some bits and pieces. Before we do, David, for people not aware of your story at Mayen, could you explain or summarise what Mayen's all about, please?
Certainly. Mayen Energy is a UK-based company that is focused on the domestic United States, primarily focused on existing wells and assets in Texas and Oklahoma. Our focus really is not drilling any new wells, primarily looking at existing wells and existing assets and using some fundamental engineering, both logging tools and some novel chemistry, to stimulate these wells and to cost-effectively increase production from these assets at this point. We've acquired certainly some current assets and are currently pursuing and stimulating these wells.
Excellent stuff. Okay, so can you shed some more light on the recent sort of Deloro investment by yourselves there in an Asphalt Ridge project in Utah and the plans to increase production from 1,000 barrels a day by February next year to 5,000 in 2019?
Certainly. Asphalt Ridge, or the heavy oil triangle of Utah, continues to be part of our rollout or of our strategy at Mayen. Asphalt Ridge has historically been a large heavy oil opportunity, well known and well established in Utah, with an excess of 25 billion barrels, Justin. Many people have been looking at this opportunity for many, many years. However, until recently, really, it was that giant whale that no one had ever found here. So certainly in the last 5 to 7 years, with the advent of much more heavy oil from Venezuela and Canada, this project has certainly become much more commercial. And Deloro and Mayen has farmed into this and acquired an interest in this. So again, Asphalt Ridge is a very low-risk opportunity or asset that's primarily located at surface. And I want to emphasize, it's not really classic tar sands like what we have in Canada or in Venezuela. It's a medium oil, actually very similar to what we have in Forest Hills. It has some benefits that it has low sulfur and low metals. And why this is important, Justin, is that we are only discounted $3 or less than 5%. From where WTI is. And with that combination and the fact that we have oil primarily at surface and the low mining costs, we're able to allocate contingent reserves and a low-risk reserve base in excess of 87 million barrels. So by main farming into this, we've added to our current portfolio with a tremendous asset and technology that could provide several thousand barrels of production to the company over the coming years.
Okay. And so can you provide more details about Petrotech and Deloro's proprietary technology? I mean, has this been tested and proven in the field, David?
Absolutely. Again, Justin, what we have here is really the economics of the heavy oil world have changed in the last 5 to 7 years. As I said, really with the advent of heavy oil production in Canada and Venezuela, you've got refining capacity nearby that really has allowed us to get a superlative price for the process. Moreover, we are using actually a solvent-based system. So unlike what they're doing in Canada, which is the big tailings ponds, which would not be allowed here, we are using the world's most abundant and cheapest solvent, which is condensate in the area. What the technology entails is using condensate with a proprietary surfactant, which allows the process to be accelerated. Both have been used very much for the last 10 to 15 years in various areas. Combining the two, we have done that in the last 2 years and have got a commercial plant of 300 to 500 barrels a day that's been currently in operation since 2013. And in fact, we are the only commercial oil sands project in Utah that's been in operation and has produced in excess of 2 years over 10,000 barrels of oil. So to answer the question, absolutely commercial.
Okay, I mean, you've mentioned it a couple of times, but can we dig in a bit more, talking about the sort of challenges and opportunities of heavy oil and the current pricing and the sort of dynamics of heavy fuel, you know, in the U.S. there?
Absolutely. Again, I believe one of the aspects for heavy oil have been, and some of the myths have been, the pricing, that, you know, we get huge discounts. And this was certainly the case back in the 70s and 80s when there weren't many refineries that could tolerate this stuff. And yes, you would get 30, 40, 50% discounts. That has certainly changed. I want to emphasize to everyone that in the last 5 to 7 years, at least half of the U.S. capacity of refining has converted to heavy oil. So stuff in Utah, the U.S. Gulf Coast, Chicago, we've got an excess of 6 million barrels a day of coking capacity in the United States. And what that means is that refineries are thirsty for heavy oil, number one. Number two, many of your listeners may be surprised to hear, but the U.S. is a large country that has a large road paving business here. So 500,000 barrels a day of heavy oil is used for road paving. Our material from Asphalt Ridge is exactly that. It's asphalt. So what you will see is in the wintertime, we get a $3 discount. And in the summer times, we get a premium to the process here. So that's certainly one of the aspects, is the pricing. Number two, which has been an issue, is transportation. Because we're almost 40 miles, 50 miles from the end user, Salt Lake City, we have no issues with transportation. And number three is the ability to mine this stuff. Again, we're at surface. You've got oil that's literally oozing out of the ground. So again, our mining costs is relatively manageable here. And the most important thing is environmental. We are the only environmentally clean oil sands project out there. We are not using high temperature or water and creating clays. So I want to emphasize to people, we are not a tar sands project. We are a medium oil process that is commercially viable, and we're able to generate production at less than $25, $27 a barrel, all in, including operating costs, capital, and royalty. And this makes this a very attractive project, both for investors, environmentalists, and people looking at good, solid oil returns.
Mm-hmm. So how does the Deloro investment fit in with the rest of the portfolio at Maine there?
Well, absolutely. As I said at the beginning, Maine is focused on large asset bases with absolutely little or no drilling. We do not tolerate drilling risk or reservoir risk. Asphalt Ridge exactly fits this. It is a shallow deposit. Pretty much it's a blanket across the whole area. From surface all the way to 500 feet, you have big, thick, large sandstones. It's basically a mining process. So what we're effectively doing is shoveling it up and reclaiming the land afterwards here. So it fits in very well with what we are doing. Low operating cost and production cost, and absolutely zero reservoir or production risk. The real issue is one of economics. Mm-hmm. And at today's pricing, and as low as $30, we are economical here. So absolutely fits within our mandate of low-hanging oil assets and production risk.
Mm-hmm. I see. And can you give us a brief also update on operational activity and across the rest of the assets, please, David, if you could?
Absolutely. As your audience may remember, our first asset in the new Maine was Stockdale Oil and Gas, which was the Austin Chalk Well, or wells rather, near San Antonio. We re-entered the initial well, and we got some very nice rates with the existing zone that was perforated. We logged the well, and we identified an additional zone, which we have perforated, and that has done very well at over 15, 16 barrels a day, unstimulated and by choking back the water. What we expect to achieve in the next 2-3 weeks is to secure a permit to be able to re-inject the water back into the existing zone. And with that, we will remove the plug, stimulate, and we will be commingling both zones. And we again expect to see a highly commercial rate of 35 barrels a day plus, while producing about 300, 400 barrels of water. And at the same time, we'll be bringing on the extra 9 or 10 wells in the area. What's critical for your audience to remember is that, albeit we are producing water, because we are re-injecting it back into a highly porous zone, the operating cost of this entire field is less than $100 a day, hence less than a dollar a barrel to produce this oil. So it becomes very manageable with these high water cuts. So we continue to finish that asset base and roll that out. At the same time, we have completed the first well of our Forest Hills asset, which continues to exceed our wildest expectations. The first well actually came in and flushed over 150 barrels over the first few hours and continues to do over 35, 40 barrels a day. What we have learned, Justin, is that the choke point or the bottleneck is not the reservoir. It's the tubing and basically the plumbing of the reservoir. Imagine pumping toothpaste up a small little annular space, up a tubing and pump. We expect to complete another 3 wells shortly. And basically, we will change the tubing to a larger tubing size and change the pump, which will allow for higher efficiencies. So we expect to get another 3-4 wells on. And as per our earlier press release, we expect to hit 125, 150 barrels a day shortly and start to roll out the additional 30, 40 wells. What's very nice about this field is that we have seen some previous data that suggests that the reserves on this field, previous reserves numbers that were allocated, were significantly higher than what we expected. And that is in line with what we thought. As heavy oil prices continue to increase and the differential lowers, those reserves will increase. And I think your audience will be very happy with the reserves numbers that will be coming out in the next few months.
Excellent stuff. Well, David, one final thing. If someone's listening to this and like the sound of where the story's going, but are not yet following the story on Vox Markets, give them 3 quick reasons why they should hit that follow button, please.
Well, absolutely. Number one, Justin, is the people. I think the new Mayan has assembled a great number of experienced people from the oil field that are very good at both finding and commercializing the current inventory of projects. And that's critical, Justin. Just because you've got a great asset or a great technology, which is what Petrotech had or some of these folks, it takes the ability to put a team that has successfully commercialized that technology or that asset. So between DeLauro and between Mayan, we've got well over 100 years of folks from Texaco and basically industry-known players that can both commercialize and secure new assets, number one. Number two is we've got a great inventory base. We've got low-risk product that we will be working over and on a regular basis be increasing our production numbers from cash flows positive to basically being a sustainable business that does not need any more capital to where it can grow itself. And number three is the general dynamics of the market continue to excite me to where at these numbers we're already cash flow positive and at $30 we're cash flow positive. But with where we see the market going, I think the balance sheet and the cash flow position of Maine continues to excite me, and those numbers will just increase further with the direction of the macroeconomics.
Excellent, David. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future.
Absolutely, Justin. Have a good morning. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Louis Coetzee, CEO of Kibo Mining. That's K-I-B-O, ticker. Louis, thanks for joining me.
Good day, Justin. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, we've had several bits of news out since we last spoke, so we'll catch up on those. But before we do, for people not aware of your story, Kibo's story, Louis, give them a brief summary as to what you're all about, please.
Well, Justin, Kibo is a exploration and development, more development company than anything else at the moment. All its assets are focused in Tanzania, where we are developing the Mbeya Coal to Power project, which is also our flagship project. We are also developing, working on the Aneti Nickel project. And then Kibo is also still the 57% shareholder in Katoro Gold, who is developing a gold project or a gold mine in the Mwanza area, the Lake Victoria goldfields.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, let's talk about the flagship project, the Mbeya Coal to Power project. You were awarded an ESIA certificate from the government on October the 27th there. Explain the significance of this, Lou, if you could.
Yeah, it is indeed very significant, Justin. And the reason for that is that we have received the environmental and social impact assessment certification for both the coal mine component as well as the power plant component of the Mbeya Coal to Power project. So the entire project has now been certificated from an environmental compliance point of view. And this is really important because if we did not get environmental certification, we would not have any project. Doesn't matter how good the economics are, doesn't matter how good it is from a technical point of view. Our key and most important license to operate is environmental certification. It is also very important to note and understand out of this that this environmental certification means that from the government's perspective in Tanzania, we are deemed to be compliant with all the required standards to operate a coal-fired power station in Tanzania. In other words, we comply with all the required environmental requirements and standards to operate such a plant, which is really critical for us in this environment. But more importantly, mm-hmm. is the fact that this is also an indirect political endorsement of the project. There is absolutely no way that we would have received the certification if we did not have the firm and resolute support from the government side for this project.
Yeah, so it's not only is it needed, you know, critically to go ahead, it's very symbolic, I suppose. So so moving forward then, and I mean, this is quite an important announcement as well, I assume. You've just completed an updated MOU. What's all this about? Can you take us through this, please?
Yeah, this is very important, and this is, again, one of those very difficult announcements to make because it can very easily be misunderstood or put in the wrong context. The significance of today's announcement is the fact that we've been able to bring all the stakeholders, all the parties that are concerned and involved in the MCPP to a point where we all understand that we've lost time, that we've lost a lot of time due to delays that were beyond our control. We couldn't do anything about this. But those parties that are with us in this, specifically from the government side, acknowledged and recognized this. And we agreed to look at a way where we can fast track the whole process going forward. So the announcement today is very important from the following perspectives. One, that all parties are committed and very, very determined to see the process going forward, going faster and quicker, as fast as possible, but also in a way where we can make up for lost time. That also secondly brought us to a point where we had to review the entire process which was underway and retool that, rework that to come to a point where we can actually achieve a position where we, one, make up for lost time, two, gain time, in other words, fast track the process going forward. So it is a significant breakthrough in the sense that it has now brought all the stakeholders together, very focused, very clear on where we need to go to bring this to fruition, to bring us to a point where we can sign the PPA. And very importantly, this was given to us in writing. It is a very firm commitment from all the parties concerned, and it's something that we've not had up to this point in time, where this consensus agreement on what needs to be done on making sure that we get this done in the quickest and shortest possible time is now a formal arrangement between all the parties that are working on it.
Excellent. So, and so what is the next sort of, sort of milestone here, Louis?
As we've stated in today's announcement, the next step is to just let the MOU complete the administrative process that it has to go through. The most important thing is to note that this has been approved already, that it's been approved by the highest body that has a say over this. And it's now going through an administrative process to get all the endorsements that it requires, which will allow us then to sign the document, sign the MOU. Important to understand is that that MOU sets out the process, the procedure, and the guidelines by which we will agree the power purchase agreement for this MCPP. And it also incorporates now the new shortened, expedited timelines within which we are hoping to achieve this. So first, sign the MOU, which is imminent. Two, then engage in the formal process of agreeing and finalizing the PPA. Sign the PPA, get financial close completed, and start construction on the project.
Excellent stuff, Louis. And so as far as you're concerned, everything's on track, yeah?
I am. I'm very optimistic and very excited on where we are at the moment. I can honestly say that we all know that over the last year, we've had severe delays due to various policy changes, structural changes, management changes. Over the past 2 months, we've seen that most of this has now been completed, at least from what we can see in the system. And what I'm really encouraged about is to see the very clear and crisp focus from the government side on getting the most important things done now towards meeting those critical energy demands and meeting socioeconomic development targets, of which this project, as we've stated over and over again, is a pivotal project in creating or enabling those things that I've mentioned.
Yeah, and before you go, you did a sort of present at the One Belt, One Road Summit in Beijing recently. It's probably worth having a quick mention about that. So, you know, what was it like there? Who did you meet? Just take us through it, Lou.
Well, if I have to tell you everybody that I met, we don't have enough time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, some projects focused, specific. I mean, yeah, you know, what was it like there?
No, fair enough. I mean, the important thing was, and from a Kibo perspective, we are very honored we're very honored to have been invited, mm-hmm. because our input and our participation at the conference was to explain and discuss how you should go about developing projects like the MCPP, infrastructure projects, energy projects. How do you create the partnerships? How do you build the partnerships? And we were invited because there's a much wider recognition than what I realized in and appreciation for what we've done on the MCPP and the success that we've achieved so far, although some shareholders might disagree with me on the success part. But we were asked to discuss this, to give inputs on how one should approach this, what are the critical strategies that you put in place, how do you liaise with your various stakeholders, how do you bring them on board, and how do you move a project forward towards conclusion or successful conclusion. So that was our participation. At the same time, it also provided us with the opportunity to meet with prospective investors with whom we have on the equity part, with whom we have ongoing conversation and discussion, as we've announced, and with whom I am happy to say we've had some very, very productive conversations.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, the fact that you are invited to present that means you have that connection there, which is, of course, a huge asset. So, Louis, for people listening to this right now who are not following the story on Vox Markets, give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please.
I think at the moment the three reasons is that, one, we have a flagship project that is continuing to grow in stature, continuing to grow in value, and that will deliver handsome returns to shareholders, or which we hope will return handsome returns to shareholders in the not too far future. Secondly, Kibo is also involved in developing other diversified interests and projects in country, which are coming along at the moment quite nicely. And then in the last place is a more longer term, confidence thing, and that is that we've consistently demonstrated our ability to weather the storms, to keep focused during adverse times, and keep on delivering through these times.
Excellent stuff, Louis. Good to chat to you, and hopefully speak again soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. It's Russ Mould. You all right, Russ?
I'm very well, Justin. How are you?
Good, thanks. Yeah, and I was on Twitter while I was waiting to chat to you then. I quickly looked and I followed Donald Trump, the president, of course, and he literally tweeted that second. And, you know, so he's up early, but I mean, like I said, it's very early for him. He's probably in bed tweeting this, but he's talking about the economy, and he said, great stocks and economy numbers. If we get tax reform, it'll be greater even. And then within seconds, about 25 replies, most of them abuse. And I'm thinking, why does he bother with Twitter? I don't understand why. It's not presidential, is it? You know?
It doesn't strike me as being such. I mean, you've conjured up all sorts of ghastly images of him lying there in his silk pyjamas.
It is silk, yeah. I thought the same thing.
Just lying there like Hugh Hefner or something with his silk jammies on. No, I mean, it conjures up all kinds of terrible images. But I mean, I guess what you can say is that, you know, the US economy has just put up, according to the official numbers, 2.3% GDP growth, which it actually hasn't done for quite a long time. Yeah. So I'm sure that he and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin are feeling quite pleased about that. Equally, you know, the quality of that increase wasn't great. It was achieved by a decline in the US personal savings rate to levels that you normally see during recessions. Mm-hmm. There was a bit of inventory build in there. So you do slightly worry that the quality isn't fantastic. But, and tax reform, we'll see. I mean, his own Republican Party are tying themselves in knots about it. We've still got the Democrats who obviously aren't happy about a lot of it. So it's hard to see exactly what's going to be achieved without some compromise. US corporate taxation as a percentage of profits is already quite low. So I'm not sure it's going to make a massive transformational difference. But I think Goldman Sachs did a piece whereby it was something like 1 percentage point off the, you know, or a certain percentage point off the US corporate tax rate was worth sort of 5 or 6% on corporate earnings. So they're clearly excited about it, but I'm not sure the official stats actually back that up. I guess what you would argue is if the US corporation tax does rattle down from 35% to 20%, and there is a holiday for those assets that are overseas, that then some of that money may flow back. But what corporations then do with it, will they invest it? Will they just simply use it for more share buybacks? It's not clear. So I wouldn't want to, you know, put my shirt on it being completely transformational. The stock market's already up 20% over the last year or so, so a lot of it's baked in anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
I would just be a little bit careful, but you know, I can understand why. Look, it's a lovely narrative. It worked brilliantly under Reagan. And, you know, Reagan took over in late 80, early 81, and within 2 years, US GDP growth was romping along at 8%. Mm-hmm. Now, nobody's expecting that. But just don't forget, Reagan was starting off when interest rates were at 17% and going down. Inflation was at double digit and going down. Debt to GDP was 35%. There was loads of room for it to go up. And the US stock market was coming out of a three-year bull market. And it was on a P of about 10. You know, Trump is inheriting the directly opposite situation. Interest rates are rock bottom and going up. Inflation, in theory, is rock bottom and going up. Debt to GDP is 100% and, frankly, is at uncomfortable levels already. And, you know, on a sort of Case-Shiller PE, the American market's only been twice more expensive in its history. So if Trump does fail, and whatever you think of him, if Trump does fail, I'm not necessarily sure it'll be his fault, because he's inherited a situation that was, you know, much tougher than the one that Reagan did 36, 37 years ago. So the parallels are very tempting, but I'm not sure it's as clear-cut as that. Equally, again, markets love simple stories. This is a good simple story. A lot of we're all a bit growth-starved, and anything that's perceived to be generating growth will go down well until, of course, or it fails, if it fails.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, like I said, it's one of those things. It's pretty much baked in, I think. You know, it's, and the old adage, you know, buy on rumour, sell on fact, is almost within.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah. I think a lot of it is in the window, particularly with US valuations. You know, I was doing an investor conference this week, and people were saying, well, where do you think there is value? And it's the same old story. You can have cheap stocks and good news, just not both at the same time. So if you're looking for really cheap stocks, you've got to go where, frankly, nobody's looking or everybody's pretty downbeaten. You end up looking at things that, frankly, don't seem terribly appealing. You know, you obviously need to address questions of whether there are structural or cyclical problems. You know, what's bombed out? Retailers are bombed out. Oil stocks are bombed out. Emerging markets are still relatively cheap compared to their history. People are worried about commodities. They're worried about, you know, politics. You know, Japan is kind of okay. You know, an area that, you know, is sometimes a country that's sometimes quite difficult to get your head around. So there are, you know, media stocks are generally pretty bombed out again because people just think the print thing's dead and there's going to be, you know, so there are lots of different things working against those sectors. So those are the really, really cheap ones. You know, the areas where you would say people are generally pretty optimistic, US, you know, cryptocurrencies, tech stocks, are the areas where you would say on balance that, frankly, the valuations give you very little margin for error. You know, the other stocks that are probably bombed out are real estate investment trusts, because again, people worry about the trickle-down effect of bricks and mortar. But you've got big cap UK REITs like British Land and Land Securities trading at a 35% discount to NAV. So the market's effectively priced in a massive drop in rents and property values already. Now, I'm not saying that it's wrong, but I'm saying it won't take an awful lot for the market to be pleasantly surprised. Whereas when you've got a tech stock trading on 35, 40, 50 times earnings, it doesn't take an awful lot for a market to be disappointed.
Yeah, so it's the old adage, buy low, sell high, you know?
If you possibly can. It's easier said than done, but if you possibly can, that is the magic formula.
Exactly, but the trouble is, lows and highs are relative, aren't they? So there we go.
They are, and I must admit, I think the market just feels a bit funny to me. I've just been writing a piece for somebody else. Just, you know, it's become very intolerant of any minor disappointment. I know Carillion's obviously a spectacular problem, got spectacular problems of its own. But, you know, stocks like, you know, value stocks, I would argue, or turnaround stocks, like TalkTalk, like Marks and Spencer's, or you've had Burberry where it's been talking about future investment. The market just has not been interested. It wants jam today. It's not interested in jam tomorrow. Yeah. Stocks that have got a lot of debt are being kicked around. You're getting a lot of, although the indices are very calm, there's a lot of individual stock volatility, and market leadership is very narrow right now. There aren't many sectors. I've just done the numbers. Over the last month, I think there are 24 FTSE 100 stocks that are up. Over the last year, it's 68. So leadership is narrowing. It's narrowing towards momentum and growth plays.
Yeah, well,
so I, just those things that you see, sort of, you know, it just makes me feel
I've noticed
just a
bit of volatility.
You're right.
No, I've noticed it this week in my stocks, my portfolio, my volatility is. I mean, I've had a couple of days this week where I've seen a lot of red, and I think, where's that come from? And they've just bounced back a little bit, and then but they've had a lot of red, been a lot more volatile this week, definitely. Okay, let's quickly get these three stocks you're looking at.
Quick stocks, very quickly. River and Mercantile, Therissa and Parity.
Go on, River and Mercantile. What's happening?
It's a fund manager. We had a good, obviously, so therefore it's a great play if markets are going up, and it's potentially a bit trickier if markets start going down. Mm-hmm. Had a trading statement in late October. Assets under management up 2%. All well and good. Thank you very much. And actually, the thing that just caught my eye was the River and Mercantile Microcap Investment Company, which is an investment trust, is just about to return £15 million of cash to keep, basically, its assets to 100 million quid. The fund stays manageable. Mm-hmm. And that's going to basically £1 million in the pocket of River and Mercantile. The staff get a bit of that, and then the rest will trickle through to shareholders in a small uplift in earnings per share, in dividend per share. So I think, one, this just shows that it's actually a terrific fund manager. It's got great solutions, great products. Two, you're still getting some earnings forecast upgrades. So you've got a stock with a dividend yield of 4.8%, which is very juicy, thank you very much, based on the 60% payout ratio. And on market cap to assets under management, the market cap's 310 million quid, assets under management, 31 billion. So relative to other fund managers, that's a very, very low market cap to assets ratio. Now, there's a couple of big stakes in here. I think it's there's a 30-odd percent stake held in the company. So this isn't one of those fund managers that might get quickly gobbled up in the case of consolidation, unless the big shareholders are interested. But you've got a cheap stock relative to its peers, decent dividend yield, and it is a good way of playing the overall market if it rises. Clearly, it's going to get trickier if the market goes down. I mean, the share price is at 385p. We first looked at this when it was in the low 300. So we've got a terrific gain here. New Miss's price target is £4. I guess it's one of them. Long term, I think it's a great story. Short term, if you have a nervous disposition, you might have a look and just think, yeah, okay, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, well, the last peak it had in the summer was at 379. It came back off that. Now it's at that level again, so we'll see whether it's going to push ahead or come
interesting.
Back. Yeah, cool. What's the next one, Ross?
Therissa. It's the chrome mining player based down in Africa. Mm-hmm. A trading statement came out. Good stuff. It made 5 cents a share of earnings last year. It's now reckoning it's going to make 21 to 23 this year, so it's doing what it says on the tin. That's partly due to operational increases in production, which they'd flagged in October, and a rebound in the chrome prices, which is the really big difference. We first flagged this one, and it's come down since the spring. Chrome prices were hit hard. That I think people sort of vaguely pointed the finger at Glencore for that. But with record production, chrome prices bounced from sort of 147 in the second quarter to 172 to $200 a ton in the fourth. So there's a little positive momentum there. What you need going forward is some good Chinese economic growth and stainless steel demand. Keep prices firm and the company to stick to its production guidance, and it may then start to sneak out those long-awaited dividends as an added bonus. But it's a digger. If you like diggers, it's got, you know, in the price momentum, it'll be for you. If you don't like diggers, you'll just move away. But at the moment, at least, the momentum seems to be going in the right way. Though the share price just sort of yawned, frankly, which again, coming back to that sort of market growing intolerance of risk, I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, well, it's fallen a lot since the summer. It's gone from almost 160 down to like 70 odd pence now.
And bounced back to about 90 odd.
But it didn't get above that 200-day moving average, which is
the
bare bullish line, sort of, struggling a little bit. So anyway, it's 94 pence at the moment. What's next then, Rush?
And the last one's Parity. It's an IT consultancy IT recruitment player. Again, it's one of these deep value stocks that the market is just looking at and just completely ignoring. And it does make you seriously start to question your own judgment. You know, it's one-third of revenue is consulting, where it wants to emphasize. Two-thirds is lower margin recruitment, which is looking to de-emphasize. The interims that showed that it was doing that, consulting revenues were up 48%. Recruitment was down 7% due to some tax changes in the UK public sector. Its profits went up. Its interest cover went up. Its debt came down. So everything was going right. And the share price has just shrugged it off. It's on a PE of 7%. And you think, oh, maybe that's a bit too good to be true. The boss, Alan Rommel's just doubled his stake in the company, which is why I'm talking about it today. And it's got a market cap of £8 million. It's got net assets of 6.8 million. So there's a little bit of backing there, but it is the risk here is that margins are very thin. They're still only at 1.12%. And if that starts to wobble, then obviously your interest cover is going to wobble very quickly. So it is still a high risk stock. And as I said earlier, anything with debt right now, whether it's high yield bonds or big cap, the market just seems to be stepping away slightly. The good news is the debt's come down to 2.3 on this one, but there is a pension deficit. If they continue to do as they're doing, this is going to be a very, very long, slow burn. But the share price chart, as we can see, is very ugly. The one thing I'm intrigued by is the fact that the CEO's just hoovered up quite a lot of stock.
Yeah. Well, if they can just increase that, you know, that margin there, then they'll be flying because the revenues are, you know, great revenues.
Yeah, so you've got 90-odd million quid with the revenues and an 8 million quid market cap. Yeah. So it shows you exactly what they've got to do. And at the moment it's happening, but it is going to happen slowly. And the market is in jam today, not jam tomorrow. So I think it just feels to me like we're going to have to just buckle up a little bit. I don't think it's the end because I think there's just so much liquidity out there. Yeah. It's hard to, unless that liquidity has been completely gassed away on silly things. It just does feel like maybe we might be about to get that long-awaited hiccup.
Turbulence correction. Yeah, exactly. Russ, I agree with that. I said it, I think last week, as I'm trying to get a bit more cash in the portfolio to take advantage of, because it's not the end of the world, but corrections can be taken advantage of.
Maybe River and Merck would be one of those that you look at. You know, it's gone up 30-odd% in the last 3-6 months. Mm-hmm. It's a good company. Maybe it's one of those that you'd be looking to think, I might get a fresh entry point on this one.
Marvellous, Russ. Have a nice weekend. And
you, Justin.
Speak next week.
I look forward to it.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are, at five, Ascent Resources. At four, Zenanga Iron. At IOC. At three, Angus Energy, ANGS. At two, Greatland Gold, GGP. And number one most followed company on Vox Markets for the second day on a trot in a row is Mkanga Resources, MKA. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Frontera Resources, FRR, Corporation Collection on Arbitration Award. At five, also joint five, Motive Bio, exercise of warrants. At four, Angus Energy. Angus Energy commences production at Lidsey X2. At three, Motive Bio, /AB. Holdings in Company. At two, Greatland Gold, GGP, Ernest Giles Project Update. And number one, most liked RNS, spoke to Neil earlier, it's Vesarion, VRS, of course, collaboration with a global consumer goods company. Very exciting times for Vesarion at the moment. And I think, you know, if you're not following that company, I'd follow the story and do some research. It's worth it, I think. Okay, that's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.